This is Otis M. Carson. I'm from NYC, and you're listening to WGXC Acra Hudson Catskill.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by MPAC, presenting the U.S. premiere of Mew by Marina Rosenfeld, a performance and video installation inspired by the artist's long-standing interest in turntablism. Friday, November 8th at 7 p.m. on the campus of RPI in Troy, New York. More information can be found at mpac.rpi.edu.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Sean Mooney of Brooklyn, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
On Sunday evening at 6 o'clock right here on WGXC. You can tune in to listen to the program Lawful and Humane.
The Inhuman City.
On this program you will hear music.
Listening to the Singularity radio program, we have abducted Mr. Conductor. We are holding him in the secret facility far underneath the ice of Europa. We also have with us here Tom Ditto. Also on ice is Ben.
How's it going?
We also have Greg.
Great to be here.
From the treehouse. And Mackenzie.
Hi.
And Brian.
Howdy, man.
Cat Wrangler X, sound engineer, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you.
All right, that's enough of that. I'm Cody.
Hey, how's everyone feeling?
Are you feeling your feelings? Are you eating your feelings? It's all okay.
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. No, really, how's everybody doing?
We're numb.
That's why we're alienated, right?
Very good.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it's just...
How do we break the ice without a Mr. Conductor here?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Usually he's pretty high. And just... he just goes. I mean, you know, so yeah. I don't know.
Well, you know, he's probably conducting, but being on the other side of the event horizon, we just can't hear or see him. I'm not even sure whether he can hear or see us, but I think he can. And it's just a question of this time he's investigating the singularity up close and personal. So he's here in that, and we know that he's participating. But we'll have to cover for him. That's up to us. So, you know, typically we have some themes that we're going to examine, you know, talk about technical stuff, you know, technical issues. And I think we were talking earlier before the show started about driving. You know, 40,000 people die every year, and they're driving, and every one of them is a better driver than every other one of them. So there is this option where you just get in the car and you say, take me home. And, you know, you're not going to be brought in for, you know, driving under the influence because Sari's doing the driving.
Well, that's
Sari or Siri?
Siri. Oh.
Doesn't
Sari,
matter. It doesn't really care.
Whatever.
Call
tomato.
It.
Yeah. Right.
I think I got my license when I was already well into my 20s, like early 20s. Just because I had a serious fear of driving, and I felt like everyone else was crazy for not being afraid of these super heavy, super fast metal tanks being thrown at each other, you know, and these, what, 16, 17-year-olds are behind the wheel, like, as if their brains are fully developed. I don't think so, you know, and I'm supposed to be okay with it and get myself behind the wheel. I mean, I knew myself at 16, 17, 18, I wasn't ready for that. You know, it's a scary concept if you really think about it. These people
letting children fly around in death tanks.
Yeah,
they're not right. Flinging them at each other. They're flinging them very close by.
They're flinging,
you know, they're near missing each other.
Right, they're flinging themselves at their destination.
Yeah,
but so are other people. They're, you know,
in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a capacity that we have to avoid one another while we're in transit. For example, if you look at the traffic inside Grand Central Station, you would think that out of necessity there would be collisions constantly between pedestrians. And yet, for some reason, they just go through each other without touching. Mm-hmm. And I've been in that situation, and I ponder as I walk through without brushing up against other bodies, just how colossally clever my peripheral vision is and my motor coordination and every other feature that's required to avoid these unintended collisions. So when these metal tanks, as you call them, go running down the road, it's just an extension of the same behavioral characteristics. I'm just not going to cross the line. I'm going to stay safe, you know. Like you say, Mackenzie, mentally, it doesn't make no sense whatsoever. I mean, it's obviously suicidal.
Well, and I think, like, going to your... Sorry, not to kind of... I don't know.
It's okay.
I don't mean to, like, dominate the conversation. But I think, like, to your point about Grand Central Station, like, I'm sure that there are, you know, people bump shoulders. I mean, I've done it, you know. And it's fine, you just walk along your way, but if you bump shoulders with a car, like, that's a huge accident, and people are probably going to die.
Bumping shoulders, quote-unquote, at 55.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
elastic collision, so, you know, you crash into, like, bumper cars, crash into somebody, good one!
Instead of exchanging insurances, you exchange high-fives.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Happy, fun bumper car world? That appeals to me. I don't know if that's feasible, but that's fun.
I mean, the confinement of automobile lanes is a little bit different, though, than random directional vectors inside
Grand Central
or that, even on the sidewalk. You know, that it's just that there's so many different people coming from so many different directions, and somehow, if you watch, like, I was looking at Kiana Scotzi, and it's on the YouTube if you get it, because they cleverly put it up running backwards, and somehow the algorithm didn't catch on to that. So for the first time in a long time, I was able to watch Kiana Scotzi, which is a very interesting...
Kiana Scotzi.
Yeah, Kiana Scotzi.
It's Algonquin word?
Yeah.
Life out of balance.
Yes.
Hopey word.
Hopey, is it?
Yeah.
Life out of balance.
Life out of balance. Well, in fact, when you run it backwards, it's kind of interesting to see how people are moving away from each other in this coordinated manner. And you know that in the recording they were moving forward, and forward or backward. It's sort of like with physics, you know. If you explode a building, and there are exploding buildings in Kianaskatsi, where, you know, they're dropping a building with dynamite, but they play it backwards and the building comes back together. You realize that, you know, that the underlying basis in physics for all of the theories that are behind quantum mechanics and general relativity is that you can go in either direction, and it's reverse. You can reverse the direction if you know where it ended up. You can find out where it began.
It's kind of, except for entropy, that's the one thing that keeps expanding. So that's the one thing that keeps.
Well, actually, if you run
you can't reverse it globally.
Yeah, but if you run it backwards, it comes down to an organizational state. So, no, you can run entropy backwards.
I like that because my desk is entropy.
Yeah. It is entropy.
That's local, though. You know, it's a.
Well,
I mean, I could make it global.
It's not realistic.
4 to 5 business days.
Yeah, 4 to 5 business days, I can make a mess.
Entropy is the one thing that they say is what makes the arrow of time always go forward in real life.
Well, I didn't say that.
They.
Well, you know, they said that? I don't think they said that.
They say it.
I'm just going off to the side when you said, you know, the arrow of time. I shared, and I wish I remembered who it was that said it, but one of my favorite quotes, and I just wanted to share with the group. Time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a banana.
Mm. You got Tom with that one. That was pretty good.
Yeah, that's better than anything I ever thought of. Some people say my feet.
Did you think about that?
Some people
that's
say.
How slow I am.
Some people say my feet run and my nose smells, but I say my nose runs and my feet smell.
It's like the George Carlin. I think it was George Carlin. Like, his advice is don't sweat the petty stuff and don't pet the sweaty stuff.
I never heard that one. Wow.
Well, now I'm really beginning to miss the conductor because he's memorized all everything. Carlin backwards and forwards. And
can't go wrong there.
And yeah, there are more pearls of wisdom to come out of George's mouth if someone could only remember what they were. So
the internet remembers.
But you know, while things can be seen as coming from an origin and then going back to that origin, that's what I'm preoccupied with myself now, because I'm writing a memoir. So I'm looking at everything through a rearview mirror, you know, and it's interesting to see where the current state of existence can be understood in the context of what started it all off. And I think I'm very lucky, too, to be able to do that, you know, that I have that opportunity to look back over all these years. There's quite a few of them, decades and decades, and then some more decades. And it's good insulation from what's driving everyone crazy at the moment, because I'm afraid to think that there's no future. And now, suddenly.
Wow, dude.
We'll leave it at that.
Carlin.
Good job, hippie.
It's just, you know, it's so depressing. I'm sorry, kids, but you have no future.
I wasn't sure if we were, like, avoiding talking about the thing.
Yeah, I was avoiding it by saying, let's look back. Let's look back and see where things, you know, originated in terms of, like, the big clock, the big bang, something like that. Where did it all start? That's, you know, an interesting perception. For example, the telescopes that I work on right now, you know, there's this telescope that I developed up at RPI, which I thought was a mistake, because while it's very good at seeing one color, it can't see any other. Now, that one color, it sees better than any other telescope.
color.
So they said, well, if we look for ozone, which happens to be around 10 microns, and we see ozone, then that must mean that someone's breathing or something along those lines.
Everybody breathes ozone.
Well, apparently, you know, if the ozone starts on the surface, by the time it gets to the ultraviolet, it's converted to O3. And so they claim that if you see O3, it must have started at O2. So they're looking backwards, you know, and they're looking back to the O2 that became the O3, and then they're seeing that from far, far away. And I'm thinking, okay, but that's a pretty stupid use of a very expensive instrument. Maybe you can do something else. And it dawned on me that if you're looking for aliens, particularly if the aliens are like humans, they're communicating at very precise colors. You know, they'll pick a color, and they'll have a laser go beepity beep, and they'll count out their communications in this laser beam.
In color?
Well, it is a color. A laser is a color. It's a monochromatic but selected wavelength. So it dawned on me that this telescope, which is huge, by the way, that's why they're interested in it. They can make a really very large telescope, but it'll only see one wavelength. And I'm thinking, you know, actually, suppose we send a cell phone to Alpha Centauri, which we can do by accelerating it to, like, you know, a quarter of the speed of light. When it gets there, it's going to send back pictures, right? But how are we going to see them? You know, because it's so far away and it's a tiny little transmitter. But if you have this huge telescope that's only looking at one wavelength, then you give that one wavelength to the laser on the cell phone and it might be visible and it can send back the transmission of what it's flying past, which we all hope is a planet. And there might be planets on Alpha Proxima.
Are we talking like sending data?
Yeah.
Using that one wavelength.
Just that one wavelength. And they are using, I mean, in fact, in current NASA research, they are using lasers now at great distances. But they're pretty big lasers, and they're pretty insensitive receivers compared to what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the kind of laser that you use for a classroom pointer. You know, a lecture pointer, very weak, you know, milliwatt, sub-milliwatt laser.
That would be attached to this.
It
would
be attached.
Accelerated to.
Yeah, because that's something that doesn't weigh much, you know. So you can accelerate it to the point where it weighs a lot, because that's what happens when you accelerate things. The mass goes up, right? You know, the harder you push, the heavier it gets. It's kind of strange that way. And you want it to go at what they like to call relativistic speeds. So you get it up there, and, you know, it's very expensive to get things to go fast.
Right.
But if they're small, they can. In fact, the things that weigh nothing go the speed of light. And for them, it's... Well, anyway, that's an interesting reverse thing. You know, things going backwards and... That's what I'm thinking about to keep my mind from thinking about things going forward.
It would have to be a very special phone.
Well, I use the form factor, you know.
As an idea of what we can send. We could send a CubeSat that is actually hardened against cosmic radiation.
Didn't they just make a wooden CubeSat? Aren't they going to send a wooden
CubeSat? Yeah, Japanese.
Yeah, they made one out of wood.
Yeah.
The Japanese did that?
Yeah. And they also, you got me there. The Harrison clock, the original Harrison clock, which was ultimately his clocks were used for determining longitude, but they picked him out of the crowd because he was making clocks out of wood, and they're still running, you know, centuries later, because the wood is self-lubricating.
What kind of wood is this? Where can I get it?
Yeah, well, apparently if you have a hardwood of a particular type, it doesn't wear out when you make a gear out of it. I mean, it's a slow-turning gear.
Maybe ironwood.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I don't know what... Yeah. I don't know. I do know that Harrison was making, and it still exists, the clock he made for the longitudinal competition isn't running.
Why not?
It's too complicated.
Oh.
For people to dare to fool around with it. So they just, you know, it's on display at the Greenwich Museum.
It's like exploded? And the, you can see all the complications and...
Well, there's a, you know, a silver watch sitting there under a glass, and you can look at it, but someone did take the earlier versions, which were pendulums, and take them apart and put them back together. See, the pendulums are swinging, but they were no good in a boat.
No, yeah, they wouldn't be.
No, they weren't. There's a problem with pendulums.
Waves going this way.
Or a boat, like dual pendulums or something? Or dual?
Yeah, they're dual pendulums. Yeah. They're self-balancing pendulums. But still, you know, they were inaccurate for the purpose. They were pretty accurate. But, yeah, so you can go back in time and look at the earlier clocks. I mean... Maybe that'll take your mind off the future.
The future's fine. It looks just like the past.
Well, yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah, that's right. We did have a pretty horrible Second World War, didn't we?
I also think that, like, thinking about not thinking about the future may not be the best approach just because we need to kind of look at the ugly thing. It's like...
Yeah.
You know, like checking your credit score. Like, if you haven't checked it in a while.
It doesn't exist. No. It's a number in a computer.
Right. But like,
I can always tell myself it was somebody else. They stole my identity.
Yeah. My credit usage is fine.
Exactly.
You know, but it's. I think you have to look at the ugly thing and say, where did it go wrong? And what actions can I take today? To make a better plan for tomorrow, to pave the road toward a better future. Whatever that looks like for us. I mean, we're at a very... I think things got really complicated really fast, and I think there's just a lot of hurt that's happening. I mean, no matter where you are, who you voted for, I think that there's... People are just hurting, and we need to find a way to make a future that's going to be better. And, you know, I think we do have to look at where we need to go to make sure that...
Well, I understand where you're coming from because you will be in the future. But for me, I'm so ancient. Unless I can find, you know, the next slice of in the loaf of, you know, the cosmic time... structure that I came out of or something. If I had another life, I'd approach it the way you do. But I'm in a very fortunate position where I just have a little time left. And so I can devote myself to looking backwards. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to look back and at Rosie with rose-colored glasses and try to find the puns and remember the funny part. And you know, I gave a show down in Port Washington in 1980 at the library with my videos, and the host said to me, "We're leaving early, but when you get up, you can have anything you find in the fridge." So I went in the fridge, and I found these beautiful soft chocolate brownies, and I had a cup of coffee, and I was feeling just great as I was driving off to my next location. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me that those were by way of Alice B. Toklas, and the ability to drive was being altered to the point where I had to use a map. And, and even though I knew where I was because I grew up in the, you know, near Port Washington and Little Neck, and I lived in Northport, and and Northern Boulevard was right in front of me, but it wasn't, you know.
I was so high.
You know, I look back at the past that way. I just wrote that up. Yeah, I just wrote that up, and I sent it out to everybody in the Singularity group. I don't know if they had a chance to read it yet, but it's fun to look back. It's fun. Whereas looking forward at what went wrong is sort of like, well, I leave that to the surgeon. Give me the laughing gas, so I'm out of here.
We've got another 50 years before we get to where you're at.
You got to have to.
I know. You guys. I feel so sorry for you that you're not going to die as soon as I am. Living will envy the dead, you know. That's the way I look at it.
It could be perceived as a threat.
It's not a pretty picture. It's you know, and we need the entropy reversal trick. You know, that's what we need. But you can't, like I say, the arrow only goes one way. I'm not sure that it only goes one way because of entropy, though.
Well, you know, it's interesting talking about time because I'm not sure that anybody really knows what time is. First of all, nobody knows what time it is because that's all relative. And I don't think anybody knows what time is. It's if you try to define time, the only way to define it is in terms of space. Like even, you know, the hands of a clock is like the spatial movement. That's the only way we, you know, have a way of measuring it.
The movement of an atom.
Well, it's a vibration. It's a vibration.
Yeah.
And since it's a vibration, I'm not sure that it has to be in space. It has to be a change in something. It's a change. It's a delta. So the delta can be a current, for example. What is a current or a voltage? Voltage is going up, voltage is going down. And then you have the dividers and the dividers and the dividers and the dividers, and it finally gets down to human time. But the atoms are vibrating very consistently, and that's how time now is so carefully measured that if you use one of the current clocks, it might be off by a second from the beginning of time over all 13.7 billion years. And
time really is a spatial dimension. If you're looking at four-dimensional space, it's, you know, the fourth dimension, which is, you know, if you're looking at a four-dimensional system, it could be up, down, or left, right, or whatever, depending on your orientation.
Yeah, well, people don't understand just how many dimensions there are. Yes, there's time is one of them. Space is another. Then there's red, green, blue. You know, there are all these parameters that you can just keep adding to the multidimensional reality of inside a relationships. The relationships. There are all these relationships and 3, 4, 10. You know, that's up to you. You know, what do you want to do? Yeah. What do you want to do with it? You know, what do you want to do with all that dimensional? I mean, you know, time is passing and it's, what is it? It's 727, 33, 34.
Tom's counting
them. Yeah.
Good job,
sir.
Great
Hilbert's
definition.
Hilbert's space. Mueller's actually a mathematical construct.
Well, it's always a mathematical construct.
Yeah.
And, there, you know, it depends on what physics you're talking about. String theory is a 10-dimensional or 11-dimensional.
Or 12-dimensional. They kept playing around with that until they gave up.
26-dimensional.
Yeah, that's true for math. The math can be any number of dimensions. And now that you dimension it.
Jesus.
Wow.
That's how I got involved. I mean, when I realized how you do certain types of multiplication in multiple dimensional space using a computer, that's really where I took off. Back in my rearview mirror, I can see it now. In fact, I have a picture of myself sitting at the IBM 7350 and calculating all these dimensions simultaneously and getting this pretty picture of a throbbing heart. Yeah.
Do I have to ask?
I have to.
How many rooms did that take?
Yeah, how many
go?
Rooms did that take?
I put it on punch card.
Yes.
Actually, they had a hard drive. It was IBM 7350 was like, nice. Oh, man, it was the BMW of its day.
Did it have a massive, like, 10 megabyte?
Yeah.
They, megabyte Winchester.
Yeah.
Where you have to change the platters individually when they wore out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. God. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's the beauty of the rearview mirror. Is I found this picture, and it brought back the whole experience. You know, so I'm going there, and you guys can tell me what you went. What went wrong? What went wrong?
Well, I think we're set for our hoverboards. I think we're set for that. I think we're here.
I'm ready for hover cars.
Hover cars and hoverboards.
Hoverboards.
After
they were
scanned. You want to really add
Yeah, go for it.
What, how you're cheating bring us dystopia.
Well, now 17-year-olds are going to hover now, too.
I watch Spaceballs. It could be a Hoover.
Hoover. I think we're ready for a station ID.
Are we?
Correct.
Yeah.
Mike wow, tells
Mike
us.
Tells us. Oh, my gosh.
That is fancy. Did it.
So what station is this?
Well, what it's doing, it's not supposed to do. In it.
Is there no, this is
a bug now. Now there's a bug.
It's
it
a
just
feature.
Keeps going.
It's a feature.
Go ahead. Give us the station ID.
I don't know what it is. I'm depending on you. You're in the
I am, but
you're in the conductor chair. Come on.
We're listening to WGXC
FM
90.7 FM.
FM.
ACRA.
New York.
ACRA, New York.
Community radio for Green and Columbia counties.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah. So now we can go forward in time.
No.
No.
I don't want to. I want to nap.
What are we?
Yeah, exactly. Some little peace and quiet.
Projects?
Projects.
You got your memoir. You already talked about it. You're
yeah. I keep talking. Shut ditto up.
You've been quiet.
So.
Let me prod you.
Yeah, no, that's cool. So I actually got to use things that I actually use for development. We had a database that went awry.
Fun.
Something was writing to it 200,000 times a second, and it ballooned the database to 80 gigs within 7 days.
Well, that's
so like it stopped working.
That's pretty mild, actually. That's more mild than I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be like
say 80 terabytes.
You said 80, I thought it was going to be terabytes, and you filled them all over it.
So I was impressed with 200,000 writes
a second.
Yeah, per second.
That
yeah.
was good on a relational.
But they're like a little bit though. If it's growing really slow.
Which relational database, if I may ask?
It was SolarWinds, and there was a misconfiguration.
Oh, jeez.
Network switch, and yeah, blew it like 80 gigs. So then I was like, all right, well, we got to move this thing. So then it was like going back into like Windows SQL Server, and I'm like,
Windows SQL?
Yeah, so
gross.
Microsoft SQL Server. So then I was moving those databases around. Got it to go. So, I mean, I got it back and running, and we identified the piece of equipment that was writing 200,000 times. Like, all right, this thing.
Was it coming from another machine, like some remote protocol?
Yeah, so basically it was mad that it couldn't find a syslog server, right? Because we like change the IP address on that, and it was just hammering. Where is it?
Oh, God.
It was just
there was no timeout on that.
Just shooting this SNMP.
Gosh.
Yeah, it was incredible. So, like,
wow.
I mean, yeah, you can disparage Microsoft SQL Server, but it did take 200,000 writes a second, which is
yeah, well.
Yeah.
At least it didn't take down, like, an entire phone system or anything like that.
No, it did not.
Or an entire network or yeah.
You know.
There's enough fat bandwidth out there that could do that like crazy and nobody noticed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, that's, you know, 80 gigs on, you know, just even transmitting that. It's not terrible.
Mm-mm.
Like, it just goes. Does not matter.
Wow.
200,000 writes a second.
Yeah, I mean, well, when you think about a gigabit connection, right, you're writing that 90 megabytes per second, which is an incredible amount of data, like, when you think about it, like a continuous stream.
Continuous
stream. Where do you save that even persisting on a disk? Like, you don't. You know? So, I don't know.
Dang.
I have a feeling Elon Musk is playing with that right now with his Neuralink.
His Neuralink.
Mm. Yeah. Right? Seeing how much he can write.
Of course, you know, where are you going to find somebody that can, you know, write at that speed? But anyway.
Oof.
Well, I've been using AI, and there's a new version of ChatGPT 4.0 with a small O as in open, and you know, I'll write an essay, which I'm pretty good at when it comes to the topic, which is Shakespeare, and it will respond with a longer essay. I wouldn't say a better essay.
Just a longer one,
but and what it does is it does a very good job of captioning, punctuating, highlighting. It uses a layout that it has advantages on because it's controlling my display. When I type into it, all I can do is type a paragraph and then another paragraph, but it has all different kinds of characters. But the thing about it is how quickly it does it. That's what gets to me.
Right? Just instantly.
Instantly. It's just when no waiting.
Taking processing power on.
You know, I'll read the essay and then I'll reply to it, and it'll say, "That's very insightful," or something like that. You know, and it'll allow that it's, you know, it's not, you know, I'm not going off topic or anything like that.
So you said it's not better. So it's not.
I don't think necessarily it's better.
Its points better.
No, actually, I am training it, is what I'm doing. Yeah. I am training it to see what I have figured out over a lifetime. I'm training it to understand things that aren't in the literature that I would tell to you if you were interested in the topic. And I know that that's playing a role in interacting with other people in the same topic.
Hmm.
Because it's storing that.
Is it? I heard.
Yeah, it is storing it. It is storing
isolating
it.
Isolating parts of it.
No, it's storing it. And then
on your settings and permissions, right? Same thing.
I will pick up the conversation where I left off a day, 2 days, 3 days later, and it's exactly where I left it, and it's all up there. So it hasn't thrown it into the bit bucket. So it's learning. I'm training it. Now, I went through this once before with my telescope. I trained it to recognize that there was a scope telescope that it didn't know about. Now it knows about it.
That was one of the many, the most, or the duet?
The Dittoscope.
Oh, the Dittoscope.
Yeah, the Dittoscope, yeah. I hadn't gotten down to the variations of it, but, given enough time, I would, but I'm leaving that up to someone else, Elon Musk.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Tom, is there a way to tell something that's written by ChatGPT as opposed to a human? Well, I mean, school kids are using it now. So,
in fact, if a school is using detection tools, I'm doing air quotes right now, like LLM detection tools.
It's going to give false positives.
It's going to give false positives and like mark, you know, generic essays that, you know, college kids write as being generated by a large language model.
That's how close it's getting, is what you're saying.
It's pretty darn close, and there's not an easy way to tell.
I mean, like, when you read it, right? Like, I was using Grammarly. I'm like, write this email for me, or, like, rewrite it. And you just, it's
flowery?
Or florid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Florid language.
I would agree. Just not something that's naturally spoken.
Yeah. Unless you write in florid language, then.
Yeah.
Then you'd have to have a professor who's like paying attention to you and knows how you write.
Right.
But like, you're training it in real time, so it can change its style.
Could, but right. I don't
but
think college kids are gonna do that.
I think like if you talked about a professor that was paying attention, if like a student all year wrote about, you know, the cat was gray and it purred sometimes, as opposed to, you know, the feline figure dashed across the room, like, you know, and it's totally different than, but it's never really that obvious.
Like an essay.
Right.
It could be really dry.
If we're being honest here, in recent history, most people are very dumb.
Historically.
Historically.
We're on the smartest timeline, sir.
Historically speaking, half of people are under the IQ curve, under 100.
This is fair.
I mean, that's so then, also just an artifact of statistics, but whatever.
So we're just throwing that out there.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of the things that Shakespeare did was he invented words, and I like to try to come up with variations on known words that express what the known word is doing. Like, for example, my name, Ditto. You know, that's an invented name. It was DeWitt and it was Botto, and we became Ditto, and it expresses who we are. We had a little Ditto. He wasn't so little anymore.
Nope.
And it also means in Latin, having been spoken. It's the past participle of dicare, the verb to speak. So the dittos are spoken for, you know. So this is the sort of thing that makes Shakespeare so entertaining, is that the words didn't exist in early modern English, but now they exist in modern English because they were appropriate, they fit. So when AI starts doing that, and I'm seeing a word I've never seen before, but I know what it means, then I'll say, yes, welcome to the club.
Or crafting sublime subtext that freaks people out. And what's it doing? It knows stuff.
Sublime subtext?
Yeah, right. Yeah. What's it doing?
I mean,
well, you haven't seen it invent a new word.
No, I've never seen an AI invent a new word because it's afraid to stray that far.
You could just always start running local language models and try to get it to do it yourself.
I mean,
all you need is to drop, I don't know, $3,000 on a graphics card or three.
Mm-hmm. No, more like $800.
$800, is it?
Yeah, maybe for a second generation one, it'll still run it.
Yeah.
But you run that and then let the input be the words of twin children who've never hung out with any other children. That would be fun. Twin children and an AI together and no other interaction. That would be the most fun model.
And throw Neuralink in.
Yeah, right. Talk about your own language. You have an AI helping them create it. Ooh.
So then AIs will know how to create languages amongst themselves.
Well, that apparently they can do. Yeah.
Is there any evidence of that?
I think there is. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would like to see it.
Like their own language.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the scary things is that we can talk to, you know, we're the code talkers.
Wingdings have use.
Yeah, wingdings. Right.
I think what would be really interesting is if a new language could be created that everyone on the planet could speak, and that you could speak to a computer. Mm. So that, you know, there's like a seamless interaction there.
Yes, C.
Yeah. You can control
it.
Yes.
Nice.
Except the computer will always spit it back out at you.
The main criticism of that is well, what about the languages that we have? They're really important. Well, you keep your old language, but then, you know, I think one of the major hurdles that we face with, you know, world politics is that just people have different languages.
Yeah. Well, we have different languages within the same language, too. Right.
That is true.
Depending on your point of
medical
view.
Language.
I mean, okay. Just even saying the same thing, that, like, there may be a misunderstanding, you know, the cleave of how you were raised and what you understand of the words.
That's a basis.
Your own
a lot
emotional
of humor,
content of
right?
it. Yeah.
A lot of humor is based in the multiple meanings of words.
Yeah, misunderstandings.
I mean, a lot of conflict, too. Like, I'm trying, at least, to get into the habit, if there's any kind of conflict that I'm in, I'm trying to get better at asking, what did you hear? Because what someone hears and what I said oftentimes are two very different.
They're very different things, yeah.
And I, you know, sometimes I'll hear what someone else heard, and I just laugh because, like, I can totally see it now that it's been explained to me
how it was misunderstood.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, like, even that, you know, it's just interesting how words can be interpreted.
So you're competing for the pageant of misunderstanding.
Every time.
Yes.
Yes.
Or wait, I don't get it.
Perhaps the aliens won't put you on ice.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. I'll give you life extension.
Life extension?
Yep.
So now we have to all think about the future.
Yep.
There's a life extension.
There is life extension, yep.
Yeah.
Oh, on boy. Europa.
At the speed of light.
Yeah.
I'll come back and everything will have aged.
Well, you know, they say that the person who's going to live to 150 or 200 has already been born. I feel sorry for that, man.
The person who's going to live to 150 or 200 has already been born?
Where?
I don't think so.
Where?
Allegedly. We're talking just in general with the ability to extend...
human right. life.
Not yeah. human life, but the cell life and the replication, stopping the Hayflick limits, things like that. You do that, then somebody's going to live really long.
Well, but will they be living, though? Because, yeah. I mean, if they're just hooked up to tubes. And...
Well, I don't know. Maybe most of that will be sort of aware and healthy, but, I mean, like, wow, that's...
Well, there's a part of Henrietta Lacks still alive that's still going to be alive in 150 years.
This is true.
It's got some kind of cellular consciousness.
Yeah, got something.
Some kind. Replicating.
Yeah, that is a weird thought. Like, when you think that that woman is, like, lived on, in theory.
Yeah. In labs, but yes. In the form of cell culture and
cancer.
A weird thing that is, you know, I think it's like 200 different chromosomes or more. That's crazy.
Well, in California, they're burning down 1,000-year-old trees.
What?
Because, well, it's just the climate has changed and the trees are getting caught in the middle.
I just read that they banned prescribed burns.
Oh, no, no. So sometimes they get taken out, but very rarely. That those trees are like gods. Like in the, what is it, General Sherman Grove or General something Grove in the Yosemite. They just, like, I was amazed when I went there like 25, 30 years ago. Like, oh, hey, you can walk around these things. I'm looking over like, hey, you're not supposed to walk near those trees. You're damaging the roots and there's nobody around to watch. Like, there's this, it's a really sacred space. You're there and you're like, oh my God, these things are a couple thousand years old or more. And they're amongst us, the idiot species.
Yeah.
I was looking at the Lebanon, which basically has all these cedar trees, right?
Lebanon.
And you go back thousands of years, you can trace the spread of culture and civilization through the Phoenicians because they built boats from these rot-proof cedars, and they were able to sail through the Med and maybe even beyond there. But they're sort of like this sacred thing there, and it's become something they've protected and they brought back. But at a certain time in the last 100 years, because of the idiot species, it was down to like a dozen or less trees were left.
What?
Wow. Now they're back up to 180 to 200,000 because they've specifically brought them back because they realized this is a real thing and we need to protect this. But we let that thing go down to a dozen trees because of the a century of great idiocy.
These trees are magnificent. I used to live in Beirut.
Yeah.
And Beirut is like the perfect climate. 70 degrees sunny year round, and then snow-capped mountains rising above the city, and Lebanese cedars going all the way up these mountains. They're incredible.
And they're back.
Wow. And they're back.
They're back.
But you know what? That's because somebody thought about the future and said, we're going to start planting these trees.
What are these? These are like this thing that has done something, like had a place, like is a value. And that's something that actually exists in law here in the U.S. about, and it's something you've been talking about a lot recently, is you know, how nature is to be protected and how we may have given corporations personhood, but we're also starting to do that for nature, animals, and whatnot. And I'm glad that that's kind of like on the forefront of people's, of a new generation of thinking. That's the baseline. You don't have to go back that 30 or 40 years for the, you know, whatever it was, Sierra Club versus somebody, and a Supreme Court justice said, yeah, we should protect the meadows and the whatnot. But they didn't actually elevate it. We got to protect these empty places. The reference to it, the language they're using, it's like, oh, these barren or empty places. But the language now that we use for those things is they're full of life. They're worthy. They're a thing. So we've kind of advanced that.
It's interesting that you bring up this perspective, because this is the first thing that occurred to me right after the election, is that how could, you know, the life force that brought us, you know, all this diversity, how could it bring human civilization to this point? And, you know, I just thought there's like some overarching theme that goes from 4 billion years ago when the first life forms appeared on Earth that transcends all of this mayhem that we're seeing now, and, you know, maybe something that looks 4 billion years into the future, that, and we're a part of this whole drama.
this whole dance drama thing? Joke dance drama.
There's something, there's some force, some life force that transcends all of this pettiness, and I mean, I can see some positive things coming out of all of this because people are really starting to question, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's the phase of that, right? Like, what happens before an enlightenment phase? Absolute out of control feargasm. That's where we're at. Like, it's thing of, you know, how do you reformulate meaning in a society that is so-called rational, has looked to sciences, now is turning its back on that, but, like, what are we? Like, there's deep questions that are being formulated right now. Is this, like, the friction we're undergoing as a collective, is it because we're rejecting certain things, or we don't believe, or we're full of fear? Why are we here? There's really deep questions underlying what looks like just a bunch of dumbness. And those questions are either being asked or they're being run from really fast, and there's a lot of friction in that path.
These transitions seem to always happen in sort of a violent way. Well, not violent necessarily.
No,
but
you're right.
Let's hope not.
The theory of quantum is that there's always like a jump rather than a gradual
slope. Yeah, exactly.
Slope. I think that's what's happening now, is just the, you know, rug sort of being pulled out from under us really fast.
Yeah.
And
looking for that, you know, prigogetic jump to higher complexity or some kind of new crystallization of what where people are going to land their energies.
But I mean, since the, what, you know, 18th century or something, we've been stuck with colonialism, which was a great new paradigm that followed the Renaissance, and, you know,
explore,
and colonize and you know, usurp, and that worked great for Europeans for hundreds of years, and now people are realizing, you know, this is not working so good for most of the planet. Maybe we can, like, collaborate instead of
conquer,
you know,
and exploit.
I mean, that's what brought human civilization into being in the first place, is collaboration.
And no, that's why we survived.
It didn't always work out so well for the Europeans even then.
Yeah,
you know, because what did they do? They brought back all this gold from the Central America, and it crashed the Spanish economy, if I recall.
Was that part of the thing?
Yeah, it was part of it. Their economy crashed because there was just this glut of gold that they were
bringing. There's too much gold.
There's too much gold.
It's not worth anything.
Yeah. Too much looting.
What can
I do
money
with this?
Yeah.
I think I'm trying to remember the exact there's no exact number, but I think the average of, like, lasting great empires is, like, I think 400 to 450 years.
What?
I don't know if...
Like the arc...
That was like 250 years.
Right? Is it? I always thought... No, I thought it
was... No. The Romans took over 250 years just to fall.
Mm.
It just stretched out over centuries in an amazingly slow way.
But I do think it's about 400 to 450 years.
Yeah,
and I'll have to be fact-checked. But kind of looking at it... I don't know. I think it kind of lines up.
That's back... when you could get messages across the world using boats and pigeons.
Right.
Today we have a hive mind, which changes everything. That is like it. That's an X factor that goes in all directions, and you don't know how that's going to affect things. That's an amazing thing. That, and living to 200 years, you don't have super violent conflicts every 80 to 100, maybe. But what happens then when people remember history and refuse to repeat it? Huh? Or can
that
see it on the hive mind.
Good...
Things change.
I don't know. I think, you know, like, some of that hive mind stuff, like, it sees what it wants to see, and then disregards the bad parts and was like, this was good. You know, I think that's part of it too. That they look at the good part and then they're like, well, this guy. You know,
our ability to blind ourselves unexcelled among species.
I just, to clarify, I was wrong. It is, they say, about 250 years.
I looked at the Macedonians. The Macedonians lasted about 200 years. The Romans are a
long
grand exception.
Yeah, and they took about 250 years just to fall.
I was just going to say, we're talking 1,000 years or more, maybe.
Yeah. The
Didn't the Germans Reich last for 1,000 years? that's what I heard.
Wait. All four of them.
Oh. Yeah, four. Four of them.
That's not funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had the First World War, the Second World War. They say the third is the charm.
Three is a charm. Let's do that again. We'll get it right this time.
Yeah, we're certainly going to drift right into it.
Yeah.
The same. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
We're not going to do the Star Trek timeline.
I really hope not. It didn't sound good.
No, it's not good. It's very not good.
They had a
Terminator one was bad. The Star Trek one was bad.
Yep. Well, the Star Trek one ended up being okay.
But it had a couple hundred years of bad.
Yeah, but that was... Yeah.
We're in the couple hundred years part where it's really bad.
Mm.
Supposedly.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Allegedly. Oh, allegedly. We are facing problems.
Allegedly, we're facing problems.
You know, there's a theory that that we are being influenced in a way by civilizations that may have come and gone billions of years before our solar system even existed. And, like technology just suddenly appearing. Suddenly people are able to develop silicon into the internet. And these quantum leaps, people believe maybe there's like something that is like floating through the universe from, you know, previous civilizations, you know, hundreds of billions of years before us that are just landing on us now. That,
I mean, like seeds of knowledge.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. Hmm.
How would we get that though?
Well, the same way that Earth got water. I mean,
through the ether.
Through the ether. Through the luminiferous ether.
Yes, it helps to bring it into your head if you carve a little hole in the top of your head. Let out the bad humors.
Just get my trepanning drill.
And the good ones come in.
Isn't that what the English?
No, but that's like a. Yeah, I don't know. There's unknowables.
Shirley MacLaine had a whole theory about okay. and the Pleiades and yeah.
My mom's theory is like Da Vinci was an alien, you know. Yeah, that kind of like helped bring us a little up to speed, you know, and we were dropped little aliens in human form that kind of helped
us along. I like that theory.
You know. Yeah. And they weren't trying to hurt us or anything. They were like, they're really not getting it. This came pretty obvious to us, but why don't you go down there?
They've got sharp sticks and they're sitting in the mud. What's wrong with them?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, fire.
Fire. That's a great point. How is it that civilizations that had no contact with each other came up with fire at roughly the same time? And the same is true of, you know, language or, farming or whatever.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's the one civilization that came up that somehow was completely different from all others. And this is, like, not totally proven. It's only a nascent theory. But it has to do with the Amazon. When one of the original conquistadors, you're saying, went down the Amazon, they came over a mountain from the west side, and they spent a year going down the Amazon. They couldn't turn around. They wrote about all these things that they saw, and he was kind of laughing, like, oh, you saw what? There was a city that was 18 miles wide? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're a couple minutes out. But anyways, so they're supposed to, according to now, LIDAR has shown that there were cities there, vast things.
In the Amazon.
And they may have died out in that small period between 1400 and 1600. When they next went, they were gone, because they probably all got smallpox and they died. But the estimates are wide. Anywhere from 1 million to 5 million people live there, and they may have lived there as recently as 1300, 1400.
That's insane.
Yeah. But they did not have an agrarian economy like we did. Their civilization was sort of based on a slightly different thing, where the farming was more localized, and they did it by upping up the carbon of their thing by massively burning things. And then you can grow things in the Amazon, of course, so...
they had a slightly different, it wasn't like mass agriculture. It was the only non-mass agriculture economy or civilization that ever rose. And right now there's a lot of study on it and a lot of mystery and unknowns, but it's freaking interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Right? But smallpox killed them.
And LIDAR found them.
And LIDAR found them. Yeah. The shapes are there.
Are you sure that this was a civilization that was different from others? Because well, no, I had heard and read about